Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Global warming is causing the Arctic Circle to heat up at double the rate of the rest of the planet. On this week's episode, we're considering the geopolitical consequences of a melting Arctic at a time when China, Russia, and the U.S. vie for control of the newly opened sea lanes, both for commercial and national security purposes. Joining us to discuss this issue is Sherry Goodman. She's a senior fellow at the Wilson Center's Polar Initiative, and she's joined by Malte Humpert, who is a founder and senior fellow at the Arctic Institute. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This program is being made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Climate change has led to an acceleration in melting ice in the Arctic, and that, in turn, has opened up a wealth of economic and geopolitical resources, shipping lanes, access to oil and gas, new landmass, and increased proximities between nations. China, Russia, and the U.S. are all in the new great game. It is perhaps the greatest power struggle since the end of the Cold War. Malte Humpert, from time to time, the Department of Defense reports on the state of play in the Arctic. There's been a recent updated report. What does the United States government have to say?
The stance of the U.S. government vis-a-vis the Arctic is changing. We already had a few remarks recently by Secretary of State Pompeo in Rovaniemi in Finland about a month ago, where he pointed to China and Russia as having a more aggressive posture and stance in the Arctic. And this refreshed strategy for the U.S. in the Arctic kind of confirms that there's a lot of pointing out of Russian and Chinese activity in the Arctic, criticizing potential grab for resources, potential militarization of the region. And on the other hand, the U.S. offers very few specifics about how it envisions its engagement in the Arctic in terms of providing more infrastructure, more assets to be engaged in the Arctic. So while the rhetoric definitely is stepping up, very few specifics about how the U.S. sees itself being engaged in the Arctic going forward.
What would you call the overall tone of the report? Is it concerned? Is it worry? Or is it just identifying, taking stock?
It definitely goes a step beyond simply identifying. I think previously the U.S. administration under President Obama was very much concerned about keeping global powers, politics, or struggles between the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. and China out of the Arctic, to not bring those kind of politics or disputes that the U.S. may have with Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine or China with trade issues or the South China Sea, to keep those out of the Arctic. And now, very specifically, the U.S. is kind of bringing those issues into the Arctic context. So the Arctic does not seem shielded against those global politics anymore. And that's kind of worrying, because the Arctic previously was an arena of international cooperation within the Arctic Council. Even though there were larger disputes with Russia, you could still have a Coast Guard collaboration in the Arctic. You could still have friendly discussions and cooperation in the Arctic. And now that tone is definitely shifting.
Sherry Goodman, you're talking to us from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Just the fact that the Wilson Center has a Polar Institute, does that tell us that that's where the action is shifting?
Well, thank you, Ray. Certainly, we are the Wilson Center here. We are a place to convene on all things polar in Washington, D.C. Let me say, I think that while the rhetoric has shifted clearly in this administration from the past, the reality of the way the U.S. operates in the region has changed much less than the rhetoric. And so whereas the Secretary of State's speech at the alongside the Arctic Council was alarming to many, I think that the DoD Arctic strategy recently released was in some ways more reassuring, because it stressed the importance of our allies and partners across the Arctic region, and the cooperation there being important for deterrence. I mean, both have failed to address the significance and the reason that there is geostrategic competition in the Arctic, which is because of climate change. The DoD strategy at least takes note of the fact that the sea ice is retreating, the permafrost is melting, and ocean temperatures are rapidly rising twice as fast as they are in the rest of the planet. I think the real theme of the DoD Arctic strategy is cooperate where we can, but compete where we must, recognizing that change is occurring at a pace perhaps beyond our ability to catch up in the operating forces. And I think that should be of deep concern to all of us.
If you look at a map of the world, it only makes sense that the United States and Russia are involved, thinking about, planning about, strategizing about what happens to an Arctic that includes blue water more of the year. But China is now getting into the act. Sherry Goodman, what form has that taken?
Well, China released its first Arctic policy in January of 2018, and there declared itself to be an Arctic stakeholder, something that the U.S. does not accept. The recent defense Arctic strategy makes clear that there are eight Arctic nations. They are the members of the Arctic Council. But China has ambitions across the Arctic, and including a polar Silk Road that would connect its Belt and Road Initiative by, in the future, being able to transit ships across the Arctic, a shorter transit time potentially than other sea routes currently, and also in a quest for resources, the energy and minerals that could be available in the future, increasing its investments with Russia and with other Arctic nations. So China has long-term Arctic ambitions, and that's something that the U.S. needs to pay close attention to as the Arctic rapidly changes.
This idea of being able to use navigable paths over the top of North America, it was a dream for generations before the era of the Panama Canal. Does it really change the game that much? You're talking, Sherry Goodman, about geostrategic change. Isn't there already a set of rules in place that govern the navigability, the use of, the exploitation of the world's oceans that would simply apply in the Arctic, Malte Humpert, now that the Arctic is open water?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. Also, going back to your first point, there's something fascinating about suddenly having access to the Arctic Ocean. It's kind of the last undiscovered frontier, and suddenly you can ship through the Arctic. And in terms of legal status, there's a few things to consider. We have the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which applies in parts. We also have, depending on where you travel in the Arctic, we have internal waterways. So if you talk about the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea Route, there's some diplomatic disputes if they're internal waters, if they're high seas, if they're straits that connect the Pacific to the Atlantic, and vice versa. So in terms of resources, and whenever you read about struggle for resources or someone trying to claim resources in the Arctic, those are very well defined within the exclusive economic zones of the various countries. There are mechanisms in place to potentially extend those exclusive economic zones. And when we're talking about Arctic shipping routes, it's really a fascinating arena because it is developing quite more rapidly than what people thought maybe even 5 or 10 years ago. Russia is shipping 20 million tons of cargo along the Northern Sea Route, doubling every year over the last couple of years. Most of this is oil and gas exports coming from the Russian continental shelf. But in the future, there may be potential for cargo shipping. So if you're talking about Asian productions of vehicles, of motor vehicles, could be exported via the Northern Sea Route. Other type of cargo could flow along the Northern Sea Route. And I think that's where China's long-term ambitions lie as well, that it has an interest in diversifying its trade routes. In the U.S., We are very spoiled in terms of access on the Atlantic seaboard, on the Pacific coast, a lot of options importing and exporting goods, while China is very much dependent on a few strategic waterways through the Strait of Malacca, by Singapore, the Suez Canal. And so the Arctic could potentially 30, 40, 50 years down the road, when it really is ice-free for a few months during the summer, 6, 7 months throughout the year, it could become an alternative trade route. And I think that's where China really excels, of looking at the Arctic not as a 2025 or 2030 scenario, but really looking at it from a 2050, 2075 scenario, which if you're not tied down in two-year election cycles, you can afford a lot more energy on long-term strategic thinking.
Sherry Goodman, if the countries of the world are already hemmed in, let's say, their abilities are circumscribed by international treaties, by UN convention, why is there all this agitation, anxiety, interest in an ocean that's, well, we don't get to add oceans to the roster very often, but if it's already pretty well defined in law, what's the security anxiety about?
There are two things, really. There are two dimensions to it. One is that this administration has defined its national security strategy in terms of great power competition. So it sees it in many more regions of the world. That said, the DoD Arctic strategy just released recognizes that historically the region has been one of low tension and cooperation, and continues to urge that desired Arctic end state, as it calls it, by building Arctic domain awareness, enhancing operations, and, as we just discussed, strengthening the rules-based order. But we can't leave out the rapidity of climate change occurring across the Arctic more rapidly than everywhere else on the planet. That's what's opening up a new ocean in our lifetime. That's what's enabling the Chinese to see a new frontier, new shipping routes, and to use the strength of its long-term planning cycles to begin now to have the infrastructure, the shipping infrastructure, the ice-hardened infrastructure, the relationships across the Arctic region that will enable it to have access to those resources as they become more available. That's where the U.S., which recognized, and also the risks then, there, additionally to the competition, there's increasing risk as more and more transit the Arctic. The near-term risks are one of an accident with a ship, maybe a tourist vessel. There are more and more tourist vessels, maybe some search and rescue incident or an oil spill in remote, frigid, icy waters where there's little experience in being able to conduct a cleanup and save lives.
When you look at a map of the Arctic Ocean, are there pinch points? Are there places that warrant particular attention on Norway's coasts, on Russia's coasts, on Canada or Greenland? Are there places where, if you didn't follow, and Sherry, I'm glad you used the phrase rules-based order, if you don't follow the rules, where you can create problems for other countries, make mischief in international relations? Are there places where the world should keep an eye out?
Certainly there is the choke point of the Bering Strait. I mean, if you look at a map, you know, it really is true that there's only 30 miles at the closest point between the United States and Russia in parts of the Bering Strait. And right now there's not a lot of navigable traffic through that region, but it is increasing every year. Obviously the Alaskan population and others are already used to plying those waters. But as the ice melts and temperature warms, more and more others who may not have the same level of experience will be trying to ply those waters. And that's where I think the risk is of an accident or a miscommunication. We should also remember that communications are much more complicated at the polls.
Malta, same question. Where should we be making sure we're paying a lot of attention?
What Sherry already mentioned, the Bering Strait is definitely going to be a future hotspot in terms of traffic increase because most of Russia's oil and gas imports, exports are going to flow through the Bering Strait. And even though that is an international strait, so in terms of navigating through it, anyone can really do that, but it is going to affect Arctic Alaskan communities in terms of additional risk for oil spills. The Coast Guard up in Alaska will have to do more in terms of securing shipping lanes, having search and rescue infrastructure on the ground. If we're talking from a broader UN Convention on the Law of the Sea perspective, we can look at the Northwest Passage in Canada, where there is a disagreement. Canada, of course, says it is an internal waterway, that Northern Canada is an archipelago, and so Canada has jurisdiction and control over these waterways, being able to enforce certain rules and laws, while others, including the United States, says no, it is an international waterway connecting to international oceans, and so as long as vessels abide by certain restrictions, anyone is allowed to navigate through there. So those kind of diplomatic legal issues will over time become resolved, so that those are not conflicts that will lead to armed conflict. But in terms of just scholarly interest, the Northwest Passage and the Northern Sea Route will be of interest.
Sherry Goodman, is there interests on anybody's part? Is there advantage in any of the countries we've mentioned in militarizing the Arctic Ocean?
Probably not. I think there is concern in the U.S. that Russia is attempting to do so. I think that because it's increasing its military or its dual-use capabilities, its presence across the region by reactivating long-dormant military bases, by improving its infrastructure. Some of that could be primarily for shipping. Russia certainly wants to monetize the Northern Sea Route. And as Malta alluded to, it considers much of it to be internal waters. And so it would be able to sort of control the rules of passage and require escorts on along the Northern Sea Route. The U.S. and most other countries don't recognize that as internal waters, and therefore the U.S. could conceivably conduct what we call freedom of navigation maneuvers to establish the international status of such waters. I think Russia's intentions aren't fully clear, but that's why there is concern.
So if you want to get around the Arctic, and this is any time of year, not just summertime, one of the rules of thumb is you need icebreaker capacity. Malta Humpert, who are the players in the icebreaker race? Who's got them? Who needs them? Who's building them? And who's spending money?
There's a very simple answer to that question, and that answer is Russia. So Russia has the largest fleet of icebreakers, both nuclear and non-nuclear icebreakers. They're currently operating 6 nuclear icebreakers with 3 more on order, and those are all very heavy icebreakers. And there's a simple historical answer to that. During the Cold War, the Northern Sea Route, the Russian Arctic coast was the front line, and there was an interest in resupplying communities and local communities, and there was a lot of traffic during the 1970s into the 1980s. And then as the Cold War ended, actually, a lot of that traffic declined. A lot of the icebreakers became derelict and were just set up in Murmansk. And now, of course, over the last 10, 15 years, a lot of those assets have been reactivated. New icebreakers are being built. So easily a fleet of 20 to 30 major icebreakers that Russia is operating. The U.S. in comparison has what we often like to call 1.5 icebreakers. So we have a heavy icebreaker, the Polar Star, which is nearing the end of its life cycle. It is more than 40 years old. For basically every 2 or 3 months that it is in operation, it needs 2 or 3 months of repairs. During one of the recent missions down to Antarctica to the resupply of McMurdo, there was actually fire on board, and So that vessel is just going to last a few more years. And then we have the icebreaker Healy, which is a medium to heavy icebreaker, but really geared more towards towards science as well, and not by any means as capable as a Russian nuclear icebreaker. The U.S. Coast Guard just awarded a contract to build at least one new Polar-class icebreaker a few weeks ago, with two more potential on order. But these are all at least 6 to 8 years away. So whenever we read about the U.S. stepping up its engagement in the Arctic, it can certainly do that on a lot of levels, be it overflights or submarine activity, maritime domain awareness, and so on. But in terms of surface vessel presence, the U.S. does not currently have the means to really step those efforts up, at least over the next 6-7 years, until those new icebreakers will be commissioned. And then if we're looking at China purchased a icebreaker that was formerly built in the Ukraine, which is more of a container cargo ship icebreaker. They just recently commissioned their own first domestically built icebreaker, the Shulong 2, the Snow Dragon 2. And now they're planning to build their first nuclear icebreaker. And there's, when we're talking about larger military concerns or how the Arctic plays into global power politics, that nuclear icebreaker can potentially serve as a technology platform to develop nuclear surface vessel capability, which would allow China down the road to build a nuclear aircraft carrier, which, as we all know, nuclear aircraft carriers are vastly important in terms of power projection. So the Arctic definitely ties into grander plans to reinvigorate or to expand naval capabilities for China as well.
Sherry Goodman, there's been reference to a new South China Sea when discussing China's ambitions in the Arctic Ocean. What do people mean when they use that phrase?
What they mean is that in the South China Sea, China has been violating sovereign territory and building up territory of its own and claiming that these are China's internal waters, and has become aggressive in its action vis-a-vis its other neighbors, particularly the Philippines and Vietnam in that region, and building up reefs into islands that it's now declared to be its own territory. So the reference here is to China in its Arctic strategy declaring itself to be an Arctic stakeholder and having certain rights to transit the Arctic, and rights across the region that are not recognized by other Arctic nations.
Isn't it significantly different to claim that something is your territorial waters, as they do with their nine-dash line there in the South China Sea, basically taking this international waterway and saying it's Chinese waters, versus a sort of aspirational and far-off ambition where it seeks to be a player but can't really make any territorial claim? Is there an important difference there?
There is a significant difference. China does not have the same leverage to territory in the Arctic as it does in the South China Sea, but it is attempting to gain a role in the Arctic in ways that could undermine international rules and norms. And there is a risk, as it's noted in the DoD Arctic strategy, that its predatory economic behavior globally could be repeated in maybe different ways in the Arctic. For example, China is increasing its foreign direct investments across the Arctic, has signed deals with the Finns for a data Silk Road, attempted to buy airports and ports in Greenland, which, you know, fortunately now the U.S. has said it's going to make investments sufficient that the Chinese overtures became less attractive. But China is looking to increase its economic presence. It's strategically deployed its scientists across the region, has far more scientists now doing research across the Arctic, and is basically seeking to infiltrate and exploit the various economic, scientific, and other opportunities that are available to it.
Malte Humpert, if you took your old 20th century Cold War era view of the world. Greenland, certainly pre-increased autonomy, a Danish possession at one time, heavily influenced by the Danes who were members of NATO, it seemed securely part of the Western camp. Now that China is building, as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, a base in Greenland, it's changing, it would seem. I mean, that inward investment in a very poor, very sparsely populated part of the world, but now, as we've been discussing over the last half hour, extremely strategically important, China's sort of planting a great power flag in a place that had long been assumed to be part of the West.
Yeah, I think it's important to distinguish between reasonable or valid economic interests on one hand, similar to the situation in Iceland, where during the financial crisis about 10 years ago, Iceland was struggling very significantly with the collapse of their economy, and China was willing to lend a hand, and Iceland signed a free trade agreement with China as well. So, just kind of like what Sherry said, there is a difference when we look, for example, at the South China Sea and the Arctic and potential diplomatic disputes or land grabs, and on the other hand, between legitimate economic investments, which can go either way, right? On one hand, they can be economic investment that benefit an economy like Iceland or Greenland, but of course, there can also be more sinister or long-term strategic interests behind some of those investments, and I think that's where one has to distinguish between, a couple of years ago there was headlines about a Chinese businessman wanting to buy a large chunk of land in northeastern Iceland to build a port. And at that point, you're starting to wonder, could this be a potential infrastructure interest long term, that Iceland becomes kind of a faraway gateway for Chinese traffic or shipping through the Arctic? So I think it is important between what kind of investments, what kind of standards are being upheld. For me, it's always important that labor laws, environmental standards are being abided by, and I think that's where, in the short term, we need to make sure that economic development in the Arctic, be it supported by Chinese or Russian or Western investments, is done to the highest standard possible, because the Arctic is such a fragile environment, and to a certain point, it's quite ironic that the more resources we pull out of the ground in the Arctic, oil and gas especially, the further we will accelerate climate change, and that will allow us to get to even more resources in the Arctic. So the Arctic is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy when it comes to climate change. It's really the first region where, because of climate change, geostrategic interests are changing, and as those interests are changing, we will most likely cause even more emissions, which will lead to even more climate change and a further reduction of sea ice in the Arctic, which will allow us to exploit resources in the Arctic even further.
Well, the scenario you're painting would almost appear to be a disincentive for the great players we've been discussing, who are also pretty big per capita emitters at the same time, and will lead national levels of emissions for some time to come, Russia, China, and the United States. This would seem to almost be a disincentive, given that what Russia's pulling out is fossil fuel, and it's fossil fuel that is getting the finger pointed at it for accelerating these changes in the world's climate.
Absolutely. I mean, in a very objective fashion, we are developing the Arctic in a very 20th century method. It's very much about pulling resources out of the ground, be it oil or gas or timber, or there's projects for massive coal mines in far eastern Russia, in terms of shipping routes where we can still use very, very dirty heavy fuel oil in the Arctic. Currently, the International Maritime Organization is working on banning those fuels, because the black particle, the diesel particles that settle on the ice, have a large impact, making the surface darker, and so it leads to even more more sea ice melt. So from an economic development perspective, it is very much a traditional development model where you go into a new region and you pull the resource out of the ground, and a lot of the economic benefits probably do not go to local communities, people that have been living in the Arctic for centuries. And that's kind of that kind of fine balance that, on one hand, when a region does open up, it creates, you know, a certain rush for resources or certain ideas or dreams about developing that region. But at the same time, you have to ask the question, are we developing it in the right way? And on top of that, you have that next layer of global power politics, where for Russia, those resources are vastly important. Easy Russian oil and gas resources outside of the Arctic are not flowing as much anymore as they used to. About 20% of the Russian GDP is being produced above the Arctic Circle, and future oil and gas resources are located in the Arctic. And so, of course, if you're Russia, you have a significant economic interest to get to those resources, to protect them in terms of domain awareness, reinvigorating old military installations, building icebreakers, and so forth, and getting them out of the ground and exporting them as easily as possible to Europe and to Asia along the Northern Sea Route. So from a basic economic perspective, that all makes sense. But of course, you have to ask a louder question if it is the right thing to do.
We've been hearing from Sherry Goodman and Malte Humpert on the geopolitical consequences of the Arctic's melting ice. After the break, join us for the second half of this conversation with Ray Suarez. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Sherry Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Wilson Center's Polar Institute, and Malte Humpert, who's founder and senior fellow at the Arctic Institute. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Sherry Goodman, the world's ambivalence about these questions seems to be played out in the Arctic on a daily basis. I mean, Greenland is looked upon as one of the globe's canaries in the coal mine. Glacial melt, releasing untold millions of gallons of fresh water into the northern Atlantic. Norway has been made a wealthy country beyond its 19th century imagination, and yet at the same time is renouncing the use of fossil fuels. But after having been made wealthy by oil, Russia, fossil fuels are one of the only things it has to sell the rest of the world that the rest of the world wants to buy from Russia, really. Canada has spoken forthrightly and very strongly and unambiguously about being committed to a fossil fuel-free future, while at the same time trying to exploit the tar sands and get as much value out of its natural deposits as much as possible. And the United States, for its part, recently opened up ANWR after years of debate about whether it's time to start drilling up there. So it seems like the world's working at cross purposes to itself here.
Well, yes, Ray, you might call this the Arctic conundrum. You know, in the 19th century, there was the lure of Arctic exploration polar exploration that sent a, you know, a few explorers searching the region. But now the lure is much greater, and it's essentially to capture the, it's a very short-term focus in capturing the wealth of the resources of the region, particularly for Russia, which has the largest Arctic coastline and is essentially a resource economy. I think Senator McCain once characterized it as a gas station governed by a kleptocracy. And so its economic incentives all point to exploiting the region. And China is a resource-poor country with a very large population, and so it's looking to gain those resources from Russia and others, the oil and the minerals. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the fish. As the water warms and fish stocks move northward, they'll, you know, even though there's a fishing moratorium now in the Central Arctic, increasingly there will be an appetite among many fishing nations to try to extract those resources as they become more available. So it is the conundrum of the short-term perspective undoing what is in the long-term health of people and population and the planet.
Many of the world's fish stocks elsewhere on the planet have been fished almost to the limit. There are collapsing populations of many important protein sources in oceans around the world. And here a brand new ocean comes online. As I try to understand this, Malte, if we put out a map with an exclusion zone of 250 miles from the international borders of all these countries that face the Arctic, doesn't that leave only a little bit of ocean left sort of in play for things like international fishing fleets, the big powers that send out fleets, sometimes largely disproportionate to the size of their own populations?
Yeah, even with the exclusive economic zone of 250 miles, there's still a significant chunk of Central Arctic Ocean. I'm not exactly sure the square footage, but I would guess it's easily 3 to 4 million square kilometers. So about half the size of the U.S. Available, that is international high seas in the center of the Arctic Ocean. And as Sherry just mentioned, there is a moratorium which can be extended further. It was negotiated under the auspice of the Arctic Council last year. So that's a good start. And I think one of the reasons why that negotiation was relatively easily forthcoming and there wasn't too much resistance is because that part of the Arctic Ocean is not really accessible yet. So that's where kind of the ice lingers in the summer, where it refreezes in the winter. So even if a fishing fleet from a given nation wanted to go into the center of the Arctic Ocean currently to fish or exploit fish stock up there, they currently would only be able to do so with increasing difficulty. They would need ice class fishing vessels. And so currently there's really not a lot of interest to go into the center of the Arctic Ocean. But as the moratorium, you know, comes to an end in the future, that renegotiation or extending that moratorium may become more difficult if the ice continues to decline at the current rate, where we already had some summers now where the North Pole itself was actually open water. And whenever we say open water, it doesn't mean it's not your summer lake around the corner. There's still pieces of ice floating around, but usually the definition of ice-free means that there's less than 20% of ice flows in a given area. But as the ice continues to melt, there's definitely potential that the center of the Arctic Ocean, a pretty significant area, will become of interest to fisheries.
Wild and really previously unheard of temperatures have been recorded north of the Arctic Circle, 84 degrees on a recent day. And just in recent months, we've also passed 410 parts per million of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. It looks like this is a trend line, Sherry Goodman, that's only, at least for now, headed in one direction.
Yes, it's all headed in the wrong direction. CO2 levels continue to increase, and we fail as a global community to bring that under control. And so that's the big risk that we all face in the future. And we may, you know, we're seeing that happen first in the Arctic, but we see the effects of it all around us now, from the extreme weather events, the wild temperature shifts, the increased precipitation, droughts in some areas, increased wildfire, sea level rise. I mean, the evidence is virtually all around us every day.
One of the large risk factors, too, is that this is happening much more quickly than even the most aggressive forecast models are predicting. And I think that's where that uncertainty potential comes in, where potential tipping points come in, where you suddenly end up in a scenario of runaway, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, where methane comes out of the permafrost in the Arctic, where coastal erosion happens to a much larger degree. There's just a new study in Cryosphere magazine, peer-reviewed study this week, where in some parts in Alaska, they have up to 15 meter of coastal erosion every week. So every week, the coastal area, the coastline is receding by 15 meter. And previous studies forecasted 1 to 2 meters per year. So suddenly you have you know, vast amounts of impact that none of the studies are forecasting. And I think that's where the risk is, that we don't really even know what climate change in the Arctic will mean for the rest of the planet as methane stocks become released, as coastal erosion happens, and so on.
So, you know, while we face this, as we've just discussed, this unprecedented risk from, you know, rapid climate change occurring in the Arctic and even elsewhere, you know, at the same time, we are gaining, you know, unprecedented foresight in being able to improve our predictive capabilities. So I want to tie a couple of thoughts together here, because the DoD Arctic strategy recognizes the need to and the intent to continue investing in improved predictive capabilities for the Arctic region that will enable more reliable forecasts. And that is true not only in the Arctic, but that's has to be true and is true, you know, everywhere, including on our own coastal regions in the United States, where we have areas from Miami to Boston, from, you know, coastal California to the Gulf, that are increasingly subject to climate extremes. But predictive capabilities are improving at a pretty significant rate, and that will enable better forecasting of weather and long-term weather, which bleeds into short-term climate prediction. And that enables communities and citizens to have an ability and their responsibility to prepare for the future. And we now see more action, positive action, occurring at state, local, and private sector levels to sort of mobilize the talent and the investment and the resources to make that possible.
But at the same time, Sherry, the current administration in Washington pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. China is struggling mightily with being kind of the dirtiest country on the planet and also the most aggressively renewable country at the same time in this unusual, interesting, and challenging striving to change its energy mix as a big, big country and as a big, big emitter. But is the United States diplomatically isolated on this one? I mean, as I look at the members of the Arctic Council, the United States would seem to be alone in its unwillingness to recognize climate change as a real threat that can be addressed, that can be mitigated, that the world actually has the ability to address.
Yes, the U.S. is right now absolutely abdicating its climate leadership, and that is harming our national security. It's undermining our relationships with our very important key allies, particularly, you know, our allies in the Arctic Council, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Finland, and Canada. And at the same time, allowing China to claim inappropriately a mantle of climate leadership through its prodigious production of solar panels and other renewables, while it continues to extensively exploit and explore for fossil resources to feed its vast economy. So I think this is this is undercutting the U.S. in ways that are just completely unnecessary. The U.S. needs to be able to have strong national security and strong environmental security at the same time. And environmental security means climate leadership.
Malte Humpert, is this a temporary state of affairs? Or when you look at the numbers and you look at the numbers of Americans who are still willing to at least be on the fence, at least be somewhat dubious about both the ability of humankind to change this trajectory or whether this is even happening itself. There are still pretty high up the food chain elected officials who'll say something like, well, the climate's always been changing.
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. And I was just thinking about my own country where I'm from, Germany, which even though there's vast public support to mitigate the emissions of CO2, even a country like Germany, a leader of renewable energy, and you always have headlines about how wind and solar now power Germany for 48 hours in a row and so on. And then you look at the actual emissions of CO2, and Germany is going to miss its 2020 CO2 targets. So I think absolutely public opinion is an important part of that. Of that discussion, but at the same time, there is an absolute lack of political leadership, not just in the U.S., but virtually, anywhere in the world. There's, a few countries that are exceptions. For example, Costa Rica, wants to be carbon neutral within the next decade or so. But most major economies have very very weak targets for 2020 or 2030, or even failing to meet those targets. So. I personally think there needs to be more leadership from the top down, where countries need to make those difficult decisions and choices today, and not wait for public opinion to kind of drive that change. Because if we wait for that, then it will most likely be too late to stop a runaway climate change.
One set of stakeholders, one constituency we haven't talked about, is one that occasionally comes into the spotlight, but is definitely in the crosshairs of what we've been talking about, and that is indigenous populations in Alaska, in northern Canada, in Greenland, in northern Scandinavia, and through much of Arctic Russia. There are indigenous people whose way of life is threatened, whose main food sources are being called into question by what's changing in the climate around the world. They don't, because these are not densely populated places in the world, Sherry Goodman, I guess they can't simply by force of numbers make their political influence felt, but we really are on the verge of losing pretty significant places, pretty significant cultures. As villages slide into the sea and hunting and gathering and harvesting ways of life are simply made impossible by what's going on.
Yes, well, Arctic life for those who live there is definitely changing rapidly. Just as an example, the village of Nutok, Alaska, whose elders were at the Wilson Center about a year ago, to vividly describe and share their personal stories, that their entire village is now having to be relocated 9 miles upriver because of severe coastal erosion and sea level rise that's essentially washed away already their dock, their clean water supply, and many of their buildings. So this is, and it's not the only village that will suffer this fate in Alaska and other parts of the Arctic. But even, along our own Gulf Coast, we see villages in Louisiana also being washed away by sea level rise, coastal erosion, and saltwater intrusion. So we are in the era of the first wave of essentially climate migrants. Now, they may be internal to migrating internally within their own state or within their own country, but it's a new wave of migration that's being accelerated globally by climate change.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo referenced them perhaps obliquely just in the recent past when he said, well, people can just move to new places. Is that a realistic answer to what we're talking about, Sherry?
Well, I think the estimate was somewhere upwards of several hundred million dollars to move a village of about 400 people in Nutok, Alaska, 9 miles upriver. And I don't think that, you know, there's going to be funding to support the movement of all individuals at risk and all such villages and towns. We have not budgeted for this as a nation. That was something that the Alaska delegation fought very hard to get. But that was, you know, I don't think that's going to happen every time. And just like the cost of storms and storm damage has been increasing every year, you know, now we see these new costs that we haven't yet planned for. So these are, you know, this is the new reality, the new normal of climate change. And it's not so easy just to pick up and move when your village is washed away.
Malta, even with what's happening, aren't these still among the least hospitable climates on the planet? Are we, I don't want to leave people listening to this conversation with the impression that, well, maybe you could move to Barrow now. If you think it's too hot sitting in traffic in Miami, maybe you should scout a home in Prudhoe Bay. These are still, even with everything that's going on, some of the more difficult places on the planet to live, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think climate change is potentially even making those places even harder to live, where you previously had year-round permafrost, which made it easy to build roads, infrastructure, ice roads during the winter. Suddenly, a lot of that infrastructure is becoming obsolete. The ice roads in Canada last, on average, 6 weeks less long now than they lasted 10 or 15 years ago. So in terms of supplying communities during the winter, you have a lot shorter time span. As the ice is melting along the coastal shorelines, you have more coastal erosion, what Sherry was just talking about. Roads that had been around for decades are now sinking into the soft, you know, mush of the Arctic tundra. And so just because it is warming doesn't mean it is suddenly warm. You know, one has to distinguish when you read, oh, the North Pole is 30 degrees above average. Well, if the average is minus 50, then you know, plus 30 degrees is still very cold. It makes certain things easier. The ice is melting quicker, coastal erosion because the ice is melting. The permafrost is not frozen 12 months out of the year anymore. It's frozen 9 or 10 months out of the year. So still very much inhospitable places, and which makes a lot of these economic calculations difficult as well. And that's part of the reason why for the U.S. there's a lot less economic incentive to invest hundreds of billions of dollars into infrastructure, into extracting resources out of Alaska. While for Russia, those calculations are a lot easier to make if you have very few alternatives. If you are a gas station and most of your gas is located in the Arctic, then of course you're willing to invest a lot. While for the U.S., those calculations are a bit more difficult to make.
Well, to close the program, I'd like to hear briefly from both of you about what it would look like if the world plays its hand well from here on out. Well, much of this program has been fairly dire in security terms, in economic terms, in environmental terms. What would world cooperation, what would a good outcome look like for all the players involved and the wider world below the Arctic Circle? Because I would like to leave at least the audience thinking about the possibilities of what playing well together, as it used to say on our report cards, would look like. Sherry?
Well, let me say, I think that the Arctic Council as an institution, as an organization, has been a model of what playing well together in a changing environment can look like. The eight Arctic nations with many observer countries, including China, with many indigenous organizations affiliated with it, has been a relatively robust governance model for the region. In recent years, it's signed agreements on oil spill prevention, on a search and rescue, on science and technology agreement. And so it's a model of how governance across a region, an international institution, can be robust, and how allies and partners and even others can work together. So I think we need to continue to invest in these important institutions and in cooperation with allies and partners in a changing world. That is what cooperation will look like for the benefit of all. And at the same time, also recognizing and owning up to the fact of climate change and recognizing we have a responsibility to prepare for a different future.
And Malta?
At the Arctic Institute, we're currently working on a project called Arctic 3.0, where we're kind of thinking about the Cold War Arctic was Arctic 1.0, and currently we are, you know, looking at Arctic 2.0, a very traditional industrialization of the Arctic, and what could a cleaner future of the Arctic look like, where the Arctic would also serve as a model for for international cooperation, what Sherry just mentioned, but also in terms of economic development. And there are other development models for the Arctic. For example, in Finland and Sweden, they're using natural cooling, hydropower to build server farms. You know, giant Google, Facebook have large data centers and server farms which are used. There's potential for renewable energy in the Arctic. There's 24-hour daylight and sunshine in the Arctic during the summer months, so that would give a very reliable and continuous supply of solar power, for example. There's possibilities, for example, for data cables through the Arctic, which would increase online trade and data communication between Europe and Asia. So there are other development models besides pulling oil and gas and minerals out of the ground. And the question is, how do we go about that? How do we convince an economy like Russia to not pull billions and billions of cubic feet of natural gas and millions of barrels of oil out of the ground? And I think that's a larger question about climate change. How do we as an international community find some kind of equitable model where a country potentially gets compensated for not pulling oil and gas out of the ground, for actually leaving it in the subsoil? And I think the Arctic could potentially, be the first example of how we come to an agreement about how we develop the Arctic differently and how those solutions can be applied to the rest of the planet.
That's Malta Humpert of the Arctic Institute. Great to talk to you.
Thank you for having us.
And Sherry Goodman of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Sherry Goodman. She's a senior fellow at the Wilson Center's Polar Initiative. She was joined by Malta Humpert, who's founder and senior fellow at the Arctic Institute, and the program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producers are Jared Sport and Ben Berliner. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.